Martin Latham has been a bookseller for 35 years. He has a PhD in Indian history and taught at Herefordshire University before turning to bookselling. That's because you've got a butterfly mind, right?
Yeah, that's the reason.
He is proud to be responsible for the biggest petty cash claim in Waterstones history when he paid for the excavation of a Roman bathhouse floor under his bookshop. Martin's other books include Kent's Strangest Tales and Londonopolis. We are going to talk about his latest, The Bookseller's Tale. Welcome to the Bibliophile.
Nice to be here. Nice to be on the Bibliophile podcast, finally.
I think your book should have been called The Bookseller's Tales. It's chock full of great tales.
Yeah, I think it is. There's something Chaucerian about it. It does start and stop and have a lot of different tales in it, doesn't it? I mean, I was worried about linking them together, but there is a link, which is this strange piece of technology, this 500-year-old piece of stuff. When, I mean, even the petrol engine's finished now, isn't it? The petrol engine's come and gone. The CD's come and gone. There's something about the book.
Yeah, they got it right. So I love the end papers on this book.
Yeah, me too. Actually, I always feel cheated when the end papers are the same on a book. I think, oh, well, there's end papers. That's nice. I look in the back and think, ah, couldn't they be bothered? You know, almost why bother to have the back end papers if it's going to be repeat? So I insisted on different end papers. And then it was hard to get the right picture that reproduced okay in landscape and getting permission. So I was really pleased about that, to get Paris, which, as the Americans know better than anyone, is the book city. I've just been watching Midnight in Paris again and thinking, yeah, the Americans really got Paris as a literary city more than we ever have, I think.
So I'm going to give you a quote from the book. It's from page 2. The book of paper from trees is halfway to the forest, that great source of myth. Tech devices are not only made of colder, denatured materials, they are relentlessly demanding. Now, a paper book can be demanding, but in a different way.
Yeah, it demands of you something that you're making yourself in your imagination, I think. And that funny thing I wrote about the book being halfway to the forest,
it just
came to me because it's made of wood. And there's a great book called Gossip from the Forest by Sarah Maitland about what the forest means to us all. It could have been a better book, but it's a good book about myth and the forest. And it's a bit like going into a forest, reading a book too. Yeah, books are demanding when you feel guilty about reading them, but not in the way that tech is. And I was really pleased to find that quote from Kafka back in 1920 or something, saying one day we'll be wired up to these things. Because I'm as bad, I'm sure you are, with your phone. You sit in a cafe or at the bus stop, and you tend to check your phone. We didn't used to do that.
Well, it's all because of the dopamine. You want to see who likes your stuff.
Yeah, it's true. But you feel better if you've dopamined yourself with a story that echoes, you know, your own mythic self somehow.
No, I agree. It's kind of an empty, addictive, unsatisfactory feeling.
Yeah.
And that's not what you get when you read a good book.
No, and I don't think I live in a bubble in being in contact with a lot of people in a bookshop who love that, of all ages. You know, young people really do seem to love physical books as well, and kids, and of course recently there's been a big rediscovery. It's a great feeling.
And it may well be a response to all this electronic screens and such.
Yeah, I think we sell a book called 10 Reasons to Delete All Your Social Media Accounts Now. And that's the beginning of many books like that to do with the whole mindfulness movement embracing the way that tech is invading our space, I think. Yeah, and it's wonderful. And we watch, you know, people watch meditation stuff on it, but it's just about a bit of balance, I think.
It's about comfort too, and that's how you start off chapter one, with comfort books.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to ask what yours was or is.
I knew you were going to ask that. I'll answer that toward the end of the conversation. How's that?
Okay, that's cool. That's cool. Well, when I speak to people about their comfort book, they're often a bit shifty. And it's a bit like, you know, been captured as a prisoner of war. Or first of all, they'll give me a fake comfort book that isn't their real comfort book. And that's for two reasons. They might feel superstitious about talking about it, A, or they've actually forgotten. And they're thinking they're just saying a blight on a Harry Potter because that's their go-to simple answer. But with several people, I've gone past that flip reaction. And yeah. I said, yeah, there was something. Yeah, there was this weird. Now, what was it called? And it's often something quite obscure. And then when I ask what it meant to them, to an almost comical degree, it seems to predict their future life. I like the story I tell of the West Indian barrister who's Cockney I met on the train, and she loves Cinderella. And I said, oh, yeah, a young woman oppressed by three forces, in her case, you know, you could say race, class, and the barriers of becoming a barrister. And I met someone recently who said they love Famous Five, and he's a big team worker. He works in HR and everything. And he thought about it a moment. He said, actually, no, Famous Five was really boring. Secret Seven was what I really liked, and Mallory Towers. And I thought, yeah, well, maybe that was a specious link. Actually, I have here my comfort book, which I mention in the book, which I was too superstitious to ever look up. But my daughter found it and sent it to me, and it's called The Time Garden. And the cover just sent me straight back there. And he is American or Canadian, Edward Eger. He's completely out of print, but it's still got that. It's 20 pence, it says, United Kingdom, 20p, 65 bucks in Australia. And it's still got the magic for me. And it explains why I've always liked the herb thyme. The garden's got the herb thyme in it, as well as being a place for time travel. So I think most people in the world have got this incredible magical book that powered them, that they identified with, often at a tender age, around about adolescence, 10, 11, 12 or later. And I talk about the storm of adolescence that we all experience, you know, good and bad. Usually your comfort book helps you through it.
I don't know about that. I mean, you can have a comfort book at the age of 5 or 6, right? And that's not going to help you in adolescent necessarily.
No, but you might end up reading it. As I read a book I've got next door under the bed, Dean's Fairy Tales, I read it to my kids, and it gives me real comfort and pleasure to read it. And I hope to read it to my grandchildren if I get grandchildren. Right. And it's a bit of a sort of totem thing in the family. There's some really surreal, like East European fairy tales in it. But yeah, I mean, yeah, the other sort of comfort book is, of course, that great book, which you may have to, you may talk about it later, that means so much to you. So for me, it's a bit of a cliche, but I love Brideshead Revisited just because it's, the prose is so amazing. I mean, Evelyn Waugh wouldn't have even given me the time of day because he was a roaring snob. But to me, that book is one of the few books I'll reread in times of stress. I'll pick it up and I can reread passages anywhere, any bit of it.
You know what I remember most about that book is there's this turtle that's got these not diamonds, but there's some.
I think they are diamonds.
Oh, are they?
And it's this grotesquerie that they've tricked this poor old beast out with jewels on its shell. Yeah, I'd forgotten that.
Well, the other thing that you talk about with comfort books is the fact that they sell like crazy.
Yeah, I think there is definitely what I call a secret canon of comfort books.
Yes, which is completely different from what the critics say.
Yeah, The Alchemist, and certainly they're not in academia. The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho, I don't think that has sold 60 million copies. Most people that go in a bookshop never heard of it. Yeah. It's admittedly, it's got the Hispanic audience. My mind's gone a blank now, but there are so many, I think.
You use the Cloud Atlas, for example, one of
Cloud
them.
Cloud Atlas is one I have. I have a copy of my book here, which I can grab and turn to that page where I list a few. White Sargasso Sea is another one. A lot of the children's books are in there, but not just children's books.
Alexander Quartet?
Yeah, that's in there, and that still sells. So what's funny, you see the data in a bookshop of what really sells. And for instance, not all of Hemingway, but some of it does. Hemingway, someone who regularly makes people cry. If you ask people what book has made them cry, Hemingway's often one of those, but not all of his books.
So what one of his books do sell and which ones don't?
I think, well, not the one about the big game hunting. The Movable Feast does, although it's not fiction. Farewell to Arms and, God, the one about the war is Farewell to Arms. Yeah, I can't remember the other main titles, but there are three or four that steadily sell.
Yeah, in fact, you use this term that these are the books that really wash the faces of booksellers.
Yeah, I heard that phrase first from our MD, who is also the MD of HMV. Apparently, it's still a phrase in business. These books wash their face and still go. Here we are. So, yeah, Anne of Green Gables, for instance, can do without a lot of obscure, well-known, heavy, heavy, worthy fiction. But you cannot do without Anne of Green Gables, The Phantom Tollbooth, The Little Prince, all the Jeeves books, Cold Comfort Farm. It's like people come in, and that woman came in and she was buying Testament of Youth over Britain, and she said she buys it for every woman she knows when she reaches about 20. Lolita is another one, oddly enough, which, and I've never worked out this, sells 90% to young women, as if they want to get a bead on something.
It's an incredible book. The writing is unparalleled.
Yeah. To Kill a Mockingbird, Words I Guess, I Capture the Castle is another one. So some are obvious, some are not. I agree. The writing, and I think these shot in the arm books, they were written in a sort of almost a trance-like state. Often when you look at how they were written, the author's often a bit embarrassed afterwards. And I love discovering that phrase of Nabokov, since you're a fellow Nabokov fan, where he says what he's looking for is that little sob in the spine. Yeah, he was a one-off, and I agree, Lolita, just for the prose.
And he was so bold, too, I mean, to write that.
Yeah.
That takes balls.
God, yeah, and to risk the opprobrium. Now, we have a pile of 10 on the table in Canterbury Waterstones, which is, you know, just a small English county town, cathedral town. We're constantly topping up that pile of 10 on the table. And the other things on that table are things like Donna Tartt, the bestsellers, but that just steadily sells. And it's not on Netflix or anything at the moment.
Yeah, I've been to that Waterstones in Canterbury not that long ago. It's right on the corner there, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Oh my God, I missed you. Quite a nice big one for a small town.
So why is comfort an important part of reading?
I think we read for duty sometimes, don't we? It's interesting to think of what people do with themselves physically when they're reading. I think the way they curl up with a book is quite important. And what's odd is that situation, which happens less and less when you get older, where you forget the room you're in, you forget the people in the house, you forget the chair, and actually you can forget yourself. I quote Virginia Woolf saying, in a bookshop, you can slip the carapace of self. You can slip your identity as a dad or a podcaster or a bookseller. You can forget all that. You can lose all that. And if not, become yourself. You can just become this entity enjoying the story. You enter the story literally. Maybe you become the story. So that's... Yes. I think that's a great comfort. I heard an interview recently on the radio with an Indian writer who went to Cambridge, and she felt very alienated in Cambridge, being Indian. But she, in reading her comfort books, she could become herself and, as it were, shut out, you know, the rest of the people around her who were sort of judging her at the beginning there. So it's a way of, in so many ways, it's a way of comforting you for being odd and making you feel you belong and making you lose the burden of this, you know, you're not just Nigel Beale, the podcaster. I'm not just Martin Latham, the bookseller or the dad of my kids. You know, I'm this, what did Wordsworth say? We come trailing clouds of glory from the stars, or some line along those lines.
Well, you're a butterfly too.
Yeah, still flying about, yeah.
You suggest that finding your comfort book is an unforgettable experience discovery like falling in love. That's pretty intense.
Yeah, I think it is, because I mean, what did Shakespeare say, that when you fall in love, you see yourself in the other person's eyes? And so I think when you fall in love with a comfort book, it's a way of finding a different self, finding a new self. Yeah, definitely. When I've just discovered Tender is the Night after all these years of not reading Fitzgerald, you know, that's given me a new view on myself and what you can be, because the language, I didn't realize he was, you know, forgive me, but I never realized his language was so extraordinary. It's like a scalpel. It's like, whoa, I'm going to read that paragraph twice. I didn't know you could say that. It's the feeling that you have that poets talk about, where you discover a feeling described in words and you think, I didn't know I was A, allowed to feel that, B, that somebody else felt that, and C, that you could put that feeling into words. That is immensely comforting, isn't it? Feeling less lonely.
Yeah, feeling understood.
Yeah.
You also say that it's an utterly personal experience.
I suppose it is one of the few things that's purely personal. I know people might immediately share their likes on Goodreads or something. One of the things I'd love to do, and I never will, is a book of photographs of people reading, because I find it the most beautiful thing. Paul Theroux talks about being on the Underground in London, and he saw a woman reading one of his books, and he stayed on the train right to the end, way past his stop, just watched this person quietly, like, reading his book, and as it were, being in his head. And I think it is a beautiful thing, and falling in love in the sense of discovering how limitless yourself can be. The boundaries of yourself are not so fixed and rigid when you're right. reading, you know. Personality is, as it were, a bit more porous. That's another analogy with falling in love, I think.
You used the word mana.
Yeah, which I got from Patrick Lee Fermer. And since then, a video gaming person has said it's used in video games as a sort of currency, a Polynesian word for what a book like this Time Garden can sort of possess a value just by touching it or something it gives off. In the case of Patrick Lee Fermer in Time of Gifts, he used it about a certain green notebook he wrote in, that just was it was like a talisman, a good luck book. It had such a good vibe, to use a phrase from the 70s. I love this idea that it's a Polynesian thing for an object that's got a power, comforting power, isn't it? It's no good buying, if somebody buys your comfort book in a different edition, that just doesn't work.
No.
And I haven't read Tender is the Night before, because it was in this sort of very serious Penguin modern classic. And then last weekend in a charity shop, I got this ridiculous, sexy, razzle tazzle Tender.
Yeah.
And it's what I call a format. So it's tiny. It was 60p in Oxfam. There was a ticket inside it for Macbeth, an opera of Macbeth. That fell out. I thought, this is all a good omen. The paper's really yellow. And now I feel this is like me. Nobody else has got this. Nobody else is reading this. I can almost feel Fitzgerald on my shoulder saying, yeah, nice one. Cheesy, lush on the cover from the 70s, with a great photo of him as well on the back, Art Deco style. So I don't want to feel I'm coming to Fitzgerald as this worthy, heavy icon. He's a person with a little jazzy razzle. It's like, you know, the early James Bonds and the early Philip K. Dicks. They were trash, weren't they? Philip K. Dick was sort of laughable science fiction books with crazy covers with women with leopard skin leotards on. And now it's even Zane Grey now is in Penguin Classics, I think. To repackage Zane Grey is crazy. I want to see Riders of the, I forget the name of his, Sage.
Sagebrush or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, I want to see that with some guy on a horse looking like Jimmy Stewart. Yeah, the packaging, the way the book is really personal.
I know you've mentioned some, but you quote a guy, Thesiger.
Yeah.
And he had a great list of six-time all-time comfort books.
Yeah, including Brideshead.
Including Brideshead, that's right. Yeah. So again, it's one of these things that booksellers it would vary from different part of the country to another, but they have a set, they know what's really in great, really. Well, certainly popular, right?
Yeah, I don't know where people find out about them. I overheard two young Nigerian students in my shop, women, law students at the university this week, and they walked past 39 steps and they were raving about 39 steps and how much they, how did they find out about 39 steps? It's not exactly fashionable, but it's another book that just keeps on selling because once your first few pages, that prose is, I don't know, gets you. It's an adventure.
Isn't that Buchan? He used to be the Governor General of Canada.
Yeah, God, he was enthroned in Montreal, wasn't he? Yeah, imperialist, probably slightly anti-Semitic, sexist, but great storyteller.
You then, the next chapter, you move on to reading in adversity. And you talk about women readers. And here's one quote that suggests that men are terrified of women being sexually satisfied by books and politically and spiritually liberated. Why's that?
Yeah, I was surprised about what a theme that was. There was a book, a guide to be on how to be a good housewife in Victorian or late Victorian times that actually said, agree with your husband's book choice. Don't go off piste to be a good wife. And of course, there was always this fear of women reading romances that would excite them too much. So I think it's a hidden fact that women are the main customers of bookshops and lovers of stories. So they didn't want that to happen, I think. I think it was well played out in Carlyle's house. Somebody should make a movie about Carlyle's house. This great monumental, to me, quite boring writer in an insulated study, which you can go in. It's National Trust now, this house in London. You can visit it. And there was Jane Welsh Carlyle writing letters and really enjoying these romances and stories, which, he did not like her having her own life. But, you know, the marriage wasn't consummated. She lived through reading the stories and romances, I think. And the other thing about women reading is maids reading. I love the stories of maids reading over the shoulders of women. I tell a story in the book of a maid whose tears are falling so much on her mistress's hair, but her mistress likes the fact that she's reading over her shoulder. So women reading and servants reading were a great discovery of the book for me in that reading in adversity chapter, which I found really moving, actually, to think just how people have persevered reading against war, class, the patriarchy, and men down the mines reading. I found it extraordinary and moving.
Well, here you sum it up. You say the reasoning is clear. This is about the patriarchy anyway. More reading equals less housework and less devotion to the husband as a source of wisdom and gratification.
Yeah.
So, okay. Again, this book is just jam-packed with really interesting little nugget. You reference Spencer's Fairy Queen and a woman coming out of a monster's mouth.
Yeah, he does talk about that. Yeah, and it might really put me off Spencer a lot. Thank God he's not read a lot, apart from his role in the oppression of the Irish. I was trying to find that passage. Yeah, he pretty much demonized women.
Yeah, it's like this monster's barfing up women reading books or something weird like that.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was.
That's bizarre.
So that shows how deep the fear was that it had to be like literally demonized like that.
Yeah. Okay, so tell me about Christine de Pazan.
She was an amazing medieval maker of a book, whose book, For the City of Ladies, with this city, it was like a utopian city that she made in book form. And I love the way the book survived being owned by various amazing different women during history. She was a pioneer, I think the first best-selling woman, poor background, had to write a book to make a living. And the book is still in print. And as I say, the copy that I got had a McDonald's salt sachet in it as a bookmark, the copy I picked up in an Oxfam bookshop here. So she was one of the hidden heroes, like Mary Pellechet that I found in the book.
Yes.
Yeah, I think men get quite a hard time in the book, not the miners, but there are lots of modest, incredible women book pioneers in the book.
Well, you're evening up the score, I guess.
Yeah, but I hadn't heard of Christine de Pizan, and it seemed extraordinary that she isn't more well known for having written this book, which inspired so many people as well.
Yeah, like Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Another thing that was interesting, you say that silent reading only came in, well, kind of well after the Middle Ages, right?
Yeah, I quote this strange business where Alexander the Great's men were worried by him reading Homer. They thought he'd gone into some sort of trance state. I didn't know that. Reading was mainly, as it was in churches, a reading out thing. To read silently, and people did it early on mouthing, was not done because reading was this came out of the monasteries. And I think that the growth of a sense of self-consciousness, which everyone dates to a different date, has got to have a link with curling up with a book. So I quote that business that in High Wind in Jamaica, and I find it extraordinary that Sartre knew about High Wind in Jamaica. There's somebody curled up in a bower and suddenly has a sense of themselves, this girl Emily. And I think that sense of self came with silent reading, reading alone.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I wonder what, like, did someone just discover it and say, oh, well, wait a minute, I'm reading inside, are you?
Yeah, I wonder. I wonder why it was mainly reading out loud in earlier days. Maybe it was because not many people could read, but yeah, you'd think. I mean, obviously people must have read in silence. The growth of silent reading and the growth of it being absolutely okay to sit on your own, not in a liturgical context, it was only something that came with the growth of, you know, the early Renaissance, and definitely has a link with the modern mind and individualism.
Okay, so we're on to chapter 3, Strange Emotional Power of Cheap Books. This is a great quote here. One of the character traits of enduring writers seems to be an eclectic ability to take stories for what they are, reflections of human weirdness. It's great.
Yeah. I think it's really strange that we have a snobbish attitude to literature. So here in England, you know, Enid Blyton is a bit infradig and a bit non-new, as the Mitfords would call it. And yet, the so-called great writers, to use that word, people like Dickens and Stevenson, love these racy tales. And Dylan Thomas loved Westerns, like Zane Grey, probably. And yet the people doing a PhD on Dylan Thomas wouldn't be seen dead reading this trash. But it seems that great writers have no prudishness or snobbishness. Not only do they read trash and racy books, like Dickens was loved, cheap fairy tales and stuff. Not only do they read them, enjoy them, but like Shakespeare, they bloody love them. Their whole work is based on folk culture. Shakespeare, inspired by those medieval mystery plays, Shakespeare, full of bawdy tales and folk tales, so much so that, as we know, the footnotes can be more than half a page just to explain these references to this folk culture. Yeah. And I quote back Dean talking about it, that out in the marketplace and in the cheap books, that is still where from which the great stories come. So chat books, I hadn't really heard of them properly, and they're not very well known because they're not easy to classify. But chat books were a great theme in the book. They were cheap, as it were, early versions of paperbacks that were just printed in thousands, millions. And they were racy stories.
Well, it's interesting, just on that theme of kind of going to the trash. Martin Amis famously sifts through the tabloid papers to get really good ideas for his stories and his novels.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
This chapter on chat books is really amazing. It's terrific. You talk about the fact that, first of all, yeah, they were incredibly popular. I don't know if they were derided by the elite. You use this number, 7 million population, and 4 million of these were sold, what, every year?
Yeah, I think so. Looking here, and that, a figure that I also find amazing is how many people read things like Robinson Crusoe in an abridgment. They've discovered here that 75% of Robinson Crusoe that survives from the 18th century was in a Bridgeman. So they didn't actually, most people at the time didn't read the full Robinson Crusoe.
These pirated?
Pirated editions, when you could pirate things. So yeah, the scale is extraordinary, and it was all classes. Where is that lovely High Sheriff of Norfolk, I quote, Sir Nicholas the Strange? Remember the gentleman who used to say, God love me, I love a peddler. The peddlers who sold these things from door to door. And librarians weren't interested in them in modern times until recently. Yeah. So there's, now that they're being studied, and it just gives, it's not a subculture, it's part of culture that's been neglected.
Well, they're hugely influential.
Yeah. Spring Hill, Jack. And I love that moment that somebody found that they were still reading a fairy tale like that in South America, a modern traveler in South America, a really old, the tale of Melusine, the snake woman. And I told that to one of my children. They said, hey, Melusine, she's in some new Xbox game. So how those stories and myths, they were in all books, of course, but they were in these penny dreadfuls, as they were known, the shilling shockers. They were derided and ignored, either actively derided or just they haven't made it into academic study because they're not in the libraries.
Yeah. Well, speaking of being outdoors, you know, that's where most of these were sold, at markets by peddlers and chapmen and book hawkers.
Yeah.
At bookstalls. And you, there's a one great scene where you've got all these bookstalls that go up right along Bedlam.
I love the geography of that. What they wanted was a long blank wall, at which you also found Clarendon Road, where there's still a long blank wall by the railway, where Mr. Brownlow in Oliver Twist was shopping when Oliver Twist stole something. And yeah, along the wall of Bedlam on Moorfields, where Keats must have shopped as a kid, there was a space for a nice long load of bookstalls because it was the Liberty of Moorfield. So it was a legal entity in London that was somehow outside the police jurisdiction. And my editor, Simon Winder, when I pointed out that looming over this wall was the figures of melancholy and mania in stone on Bedlam with the original Bethlehem Mad Hospital, he said that although that hospital was demolished, those two huge statues are in the London Museum. So I want to get down there and see them.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Speaking of these book hawkers, you compare it to theater, the way that they sold, this sort of human theater. They were in costumes and they used humor to sell.
Piratical costumes, and they used humor as fruit stall markets do. And I'm sure there's many a market in Canada where that technique is used, but it was definitely used. And I quote Stephen Berkoff, the actor, who was in like some Bond movies, who came to our shop, and he was a method actor. He was fed up with his plays not selling, and he morphed into a market trader. And he said, forget five, forget seven, give me seven, and I'll give you, who'll give me fiver for the all five plays? And he sold loads of books. So I saw that in action in my shop. But I love the theatricality. I think they had to be quick and agile, like Autolycus says. I think I end the chapter by saying the trick is to have an agile mind or something. They had to be that agile. And I loved it when I sold Harry Potter off a stall in the street in Canterbury. I actually did it to wind up the Archbishop of Canterbury because he just said no to Harry Potter being filmed in Canterbury because he objected to the magic and all that stuff. Because as we know, in Christianity, they don't like, you know, discarnate entities. So ironic. But yeah, he was the evangelical guy. Yeah, it's really exciting and theatrical. Selling out in the open air and telling stories. There's somehow a link. That's what I was trying to get to in the book. And I think you picked it up. There's a link between the racy stories and the characters in them and the theatrical style of the sellers and the hawkers.
Yeah.
It's a nice creative circle. How many story tales and fairy tales have got hawkers in them and selling stories and people who stop you in an improbable way and tell you stories? Ancient Mariner, for instance.
Now, Pepys collected chapbooks.
Yeah, to my great surprise, and went all the way to Cadiz to get a load. Yeah. And here I can tell you on this podcast, the one big mistake in the book, I got the university wrong for peeps. Apparently I made a slip up. It's Oxford, it's Cambridge, the other way around.
Oh, what the hell? What's the difference?
What the hell? Yeah, exactly. It doesn't invalidate the point.
Then you get onto the libraries and library dreams. Here's a few kind of descriptives. They're labyrinthine, whimsical indirection, and stacks mirror the undiscovered self. These are all fascinating descriptions of libraries.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's strangely, my son, who's a great lover of libraries, said when I was writing this book, he said, "Don't you think you've got a real sense of infinity in the stacks of a library?" And I thought, yeah, that is great. I mean, you can't always go in the stacks of a library, but when you do, you really lose yourself more than in a bookshop. I think I could have enjoyed writing a whole book about libraries and what they mean to people. And also, they're the only public building that's a sort of, it's a space where you're not buying anything and you're not worshipping anything. You're not buying into anything. It's not like the town hall where you're in the civic virtue. It's not like a cathedral. It's just all this knowledge stuff. And so I find it extraordinary that the truth of what I'm saying is indicated by how many films are set in libraries, especially the New York Public Library.
Yeah.
Because it's this space where anything can happen.
Yep, the serendipity. You also talk about the dream of connectedness.
Yeah, I think we get that in libraries. And I think the incredible library I talk about that was designed by Michelangelo seems to indicate that he was onto that, where you had these crazy symbols all over the floor, which are still not being understood, that somebody said was the sort of algebra of the universe. And then that crazy staircase, which he said he designed because he had a dream of a staircase like that, for God's sake. Yeah. There seems to be a link between dreams, the brain, and libraries. Remember that quote I used from Virginia Woolf, saying that in the British Museum library, she felt she was inside a huge brain. I mean, Borges talks about this infinite library, and I think there is a link between going into the different parts of your brain and going into the different parts of a library. And that's what's so exciting.
That was the Laurentian Library with Michelangelo.
Yeah, extraordinary place.
You also mentioned that the library during the Renaissance was a noisy place.
Yeah, I love that. This is Andrew Pettigrew, who contacted me after the book. He wants to go for coffee. He's in St. Andrews University. He's wonderfully unsnobbish and says, we should get back to that. Libraries weren't these mausoleums with this sort of librarian shaking her finger. I don't know where that all came from. I tried to hire a bookseller in Waterstones once. She was a librarian. She was going to run the children's section. And she said, well, I'd certainly stop the little sods touching the books. I thought, well, that is not the idea, lady. Bless her. She had librarians are wonderful. But I think that they've gone through several phases. And the idea that we have that they're this place where it's almost irreverent to go and relax is just for, that was just a short period of history.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's always this tension between conservation and accessibility, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah, I talk about the guy stripping off in the New York Public Library toilets and the other people being outraged by people playing Candy Crush. But, you know, what's wrong so long as they're in there?
Well, talking of douchebags, you give us a nice little thumbnail of John Dewey.
What a creep. I mean, you couldn't make it up. I love the fact his biography was like withdrawn. And what's extraordinary about his racist reductive attitudes, where he classified things like homosexuality as sexual disorders, is the long shadow. I can't remember the number of library cards that Dewey and New York sent out all over the world that libraries were classified on his system. And it seems to have had a shadow in the internet. And it seems that even today, libraries struggle with things like, where do I put a book about someone who's into leather or something, you know? I'll put that in it. It has to be so judgmental. But as a person, as a personality, it seems to be deeply disordered and brutal and unpleasant. seems to make Harvey Weinstein look a bit, he's Weinstein-esque, let's say. And as I say at the end of the chapter, it's extraordinary that they should abolish that prize. There's still a Dewey Prize at the American Library Association or something. So he's a bad example of the library patriarchy.
But Panizzi is a good one.
Yeah, we loved him. Italian, came here to escape being under sentence of execution or something. And back to Carlyle being a douchebag. Didn't Carlyle said, I can't be doing with this reading room which Panizzi designed. I want my own little reading space. That's and appealed right. to the goddamn foreign secretary, who, thank God, ignored him. And the relation of the king. Panizzi was such a pioneering Italian Garibaldi type Democrat. And we owe it today to him. He got early access to manuscripts, put old books on display and let us go in that reading room, as I did, for nothing. Yeah. And it's still fantastic, the new British Library. You sit there and it's just, everyone comes in and from all over the world, it's this fantastic polyglot place. And I think we owe that democratization a lot to him. His idea of the dome, which is made of papier-mâché or something, came to him in a dream. So yeah, my theory of libraries and dreams and the I bet Montreal's got a great old Victorian library.
Yeah, it's got some, the architecture here is spectacular. Yeah, really. There's a lot of money here that, you know, starting with the fur trade.
Oh, right.
Then you've got like another great chapter following that on marginalia, and particularly medieval marginalia. That was just a delight.
You know what? I'm glad you say that because it's too heavy for a lot of people. I had a 90-year-old customer who said to me the other day, I like your book, my dear. What's all that stuff in the middle? She liked the funny bits about the bookshops. Some people couldn't handle that, but I reread that for some reason. I reread it this morning. I thought, wow, this is the bit that I'm most proud of in the whole goddamn book. Just because I really got into it. And I remember thinking at one point when I'm talking about cathedral carvings, am I allowed to put this in a book about books? But I thought, yeah, because the sacred and the profane together in medieval marginalia say something about human personality. And they were books. And also it's linked in with the whole fascinating thing of us doodling in books and writing in books and letting ourselves loose, really, to be ourselves on the page in one way or another, whether we read and curl up with a book or whether we recommend it to someone who we're falling in love with, or whether we engage with it in this really bonkers way. I mean, it's mind-boggling, isn't it?
It is. And but some of the images that you describe are, and I've seen some of them, they're out of this world, but they're in this world too. It's really...
Good phrase. And I think just as the chat books were ignored because they haven't got an ISBN or a barcode and a lot of them fell apart... This stuff has not been available until recently, but now you can see it. Anyone can see it on the internet, and whoa.
Well, in fact, I saw one recently of this guy, this knight, sitting on a snail with his lance. It's freaking hilarious.
Yeah. I love how mysterious it is, the role of snails. They're big in there. Is it because of their spiral shell symbolizing eternity? Or because they're hermaphrodite? Or just people's into love snails beating women and yeah, my God.
As you say, there's farting and screwing, you know, in these religious texts.
Yeah, it's like Saturday night in Soho. There's a man playing bowls with his own crap at the bottom of a devotional. And it's not true that they were part of the manuscript. They were part of the whole thing, just as the obscene. So I twigged that this is a link, I thought, to all the obscene gargoyles in a cathedral. They weren't added on to not be seen. They were going to be seen. It was a completely different mentality, far more holistic, and the sacred and the profane were rubbed together. Whereas now maybe we sanitize death and we snigger about sex. We're silent about death. We snigger about sex. These guys were, they had dancing cadavers and everyone was shagging out. And we were more in touch with our bodily functions, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and again, as you say, it's like they were almost, they're laughing at the solemnity of the religion. And you describe that, you know, the guy with his head coming out of his ass almost between the two legs, right? And that's right. A gargoyle, yeah. And that's marginalia.
Yeah, and and also the discovery that people giving sermons used to tell a few funny stories at the end, and this discovery that the paintings all over the walls inside the cathedrals were like this sort of crazy, crazy book. The Victorian sobriety of church is just a post-Reformation thing.
Couple of great quotes about marginalia. You quote George Steiner, the literary critic. He says, what signifies a true intellectual is quite simply a human being who has a pencil in his or her hand when reading a book.
Yeah, I'm still wary of writing books myself, but I do a lot. But some books I'm wary of. But that's why I love things like this Tender is the Night I've got here, because I could, you know, it's cheap, it's cheerful, but it's not. And it's, I don't know, I can just enjoy the text and I can write in that, fold it over, throw it across the room. Yeah. But it's interesting that Descartes, Newton, and all the great holistic thinkers didn't just write in books. They told us to. They said, don't just read this and forget it. You know, write. And some of them had loads of different symbols. Yeah. And as I say, as so many customers say to me, oh, I read Dostoevsky, but I can't remember it. And I think, my God, you wasted so many hours of your life reading that. You can't remember a thing about it. Recently, I found my mother's War and Peace, and in the front, it just says, Joan Latham, Aden, 1945. What did you think about it? I wish you'd just written all over it, the way that someone like Carlyle or Dee or Newton or Descartes would have written all over it and had a conversation with it. So yeah, marginalia, a bit like libraries have become very severe. Our attitude to writing in books has become very disapproving. But of course, it's controversial because you don't want to write in valuable books, and it's awful to buy a play that some students underlined every other line. But it's lovely to buy a play where just in the middle, somebody says, crap, or I've left the oven on.
Well, you know, the fact is that librarians used to erase marginalia from the period. So now they would never do that.
Yeah, I love it. What is it? The auctioneers used to call it soiled copies. They call it an honest copy now.
An honest. There we go. Very clever use of words there.
Yeah.
You also say that good marginalia will save many a second-rate book from the dump.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I say that Coleridge, people lent books to Coleridge because they wanted him to write in them so much. They actually wanted his marginalia to make the book more collectible.
Right.
And yeah, I say things. I found that book where somebody had written in the front, this is for you, but I couldn't afford the Star Wars Lego. There's a whole story in there about a dad buying a book for his child. And isn't it poignant when you see a really loving inscription in a book in a secondhand bookstore? You think, God, are they still alive? Did they break up?
Yeah, it's funny. I think I saw one. I did see one not that long ago that said something like, to the witch, love, John.
Oh, good one. Yeah.
Next chapter is collectors. You say that your father had an extreme case of collecting.
He did. So he collected so many books that we had a room at the front of the house in London that was just, it was piling up to, there was an alley through the books, the piles of books on the floor. And the beam at the front wasn't too strong. It got, I think it's 1850 or something. And there was a crack appeared in the front of the house. Basically, the front of the house was starting to fall down because of the number of books. So yeah, it was a house. My mother would throw the books out the back, I'm guilty to say. They're both gone now, to that great library in the sky. She'd throw books out the back as soon as he was bringing them in the front because he bought so many. But I think that's because he wasn't allowed to have any when he was a kid. But I benefited. When I grew up, I just put them in order. And I think in my working life, I've just recreated my home, really. So I go into a big building full of books and put them in order.
Right. But you're not a collector then. What's wrong with you?
I collect too.
Oh, you do collect. Okay, that's good.
No, I do collect. Yeah, God, yeah. Yeah, I found some real treasures. And in a town, I pretty much prefer the secondhand bookstore to the new one, partly because I know the new books. The new books are full of fads. I'd love to do a TV series where someone like me and you go and visit bookshops.
I've thought
we go in and we
find treasures.
Yeah, with our different tastes. Yeah. I found, and we speak to the guy running it. What are you doing? What did you get into? I love how grumpy some of them are. I found one of my favorite bookshops in the entire planet this year in Wales, in Aberystwyth. It's up in a back street. And it's a secondhand bookshop. Talk about Aladdin's Cave. The shelves go up to the ceiling. The shop goes up to the top floor. And I went to the very top floor and turned the light on. It wasn't even on. And it was like those books I described in New York. That was fantastic. I mean, that to me is a true bookshop. That's where I'd rather be. If I could only take one bookshop to a desert island, at the moment, I think I'd take that Aberystwyth bookshop. Because there's going to be no end to the discoveries I could make there.
Well, that's the thing for me, exactly. It's like, that's why I like bookstores like the Strand, because they've got the new books, they got remainders, and they've got that whole third floor. So it gives you everything.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, it's one of these things I'd like to do if I had more time and I was better at battling with my company who employ me, is have a whole floor of secondhand books. And have secondhand dealership.
You know what? I brought that up with James Daunt in an interview I had with him.
Oh, right. In Gower Street, in Dillon's in London, he's got some sort of French-style stalls outside. But I think they're mainly remainders of unsold stock.
Right.
But why this strange division? Why, I don't know why they don't talk to each other, secondhand booksellers and new booksellers. We're all doing the same stuff. It's almost like Israel and Palestine. They never really mingle or communicate. It's crazy.
Yeah, of course the author makes the money off the new ones and not the used ones, but still.
Yeah, I mean, we don't always stock all of Mrs. Gaskell, but if we had a few secondhand Mrs. Gaskells to fill the gaps, that'd be great.
Well, it serves the customer better.
Yeah, yeah. Bookshops have got to really motor to survive. They've got to become more interesting and more eclectic, and realize that that's what people like you who love books would like, that, you know, so do it.
Collectors, it's thanks to collectors that we have a lot of these great libraries.
Yeah, I was amazed to discover that they're not great state behemoth organizations. They're often one prince or one crazy person, or in the 1848 revolutions in Hungary, I think they set up a library. And so these collectors, and let's face it, you know probably a lot of bibliophiles, that some of them are pretty weird people. They can be obsessive and lonely figures, and they've got more issues than Vogue. But a lot of them, and I love the quote from Cardinal Borromeo that I end up the collector's chapter with.
Yeah.
The reason a lot of them collect is in the hope that crude centuries may not return. In this psyche, however twisted, of these sometimes obsessive collectors, and no doubt some of them are like Rockefeller, just they're collecting for display, but they know it's cultural capital, to use a modern sort of buzzword. They know they're doing it because these books will be lost otherwise. You know, why has Jeff Bezos suddenly bought the Washington Post? Because he knows it's time to do something to preserve an important part of culture. And I think millionaires and billionaires have felt that over the years. And I don't only write about millionaires and billionaires. I write about that incredible woman who inspired Charlotte Bronte, who's an unknown collector in Yorkshire, and Mary Pellechet, journeying all over France to look for
her. She was incredible. Pellechet was incredible. Documenting all the incunabula, right?
It wasn't particularly well, and her determination, and she wasn't allowed in most of the libraries. Yeah, she was extraordinary. And Enriqueta, who set up the John Rylands Library and didn't name it after herself, named it after John Rylands. Yeah, I think private passions, collectors like the Spencers and Toxic Topham, it's a really fascinating subject. And actually, I'd like to write a next book just about collecting. Why we do it, because collecting's got a bad rap recently with feng shui and everything. that we shouldn't have a lot of stuff. This crap about, you know, that I think you know the book, Marie Kondo. She's very popular.
Yes, I haven't looked. Simplify or whatever it is.
Yeah, the buzzword in there is if something doesn't spark joy and you haven't looked at it for a year, get rid of it. Well, if we apply that to books, I'm afraid civilization is going to go down the pan.
You quote, I think it's Thomas Rawlinson who says he collects because of the potential for avoiding history's errors. So same idea.
Yeah, he said that as well as Borromeo. Yes, fantastic.
Yeah. Just winding down here, you hired David Mitchell, the author David Mitchell, to be a bookseller.
Yeah, this young, insecure, verbose student who, to be honest, I don't put it in the book, but I still feel guilty because I had to tick him off for talking to customers too much. Yeah. He would get long, involved conversations. And I'd say, you know, David, can you just be a bit more, you know, let's move on, let's snap it up a bit. But he was absolutely a treasure to be served by. And so many people who don't know they were served and bought a book by David Mitchell. Just as so many people, there's people who don't know they were served by Umberto Eco in the basement. Great bookseller, an example of an eclectic mind as well.
Well, I was going to say, you know, your book reminds me a little bit of David, because it's just so chock full of interesting bits and pieces, you know.
And history, I suppose, I couldn't believe in A Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. He's a historian, apart from anything else. His detailed knowledge of history, you know, it blows away many an academic study of an era, because he evokes it as well as knowing the detail and of how things were in Japan when early Dutch traders were there. So a lot of it, I think, is history. And also, he's a student of human nature, isn't he? I mean, that collector I put in there, Toxic Topham, that was unnecessary to put him in. He was just such a wild, bonkers, awful character like Dewey that I just couldn't resist evoking him and bringing him into the light. So, yeah, an interest in the variegated nature of human nature.
One of the questions that you used interviewing potential booksellers was, who would win a fight in a pub car park between a vampire and a werewolf?
Yeah.
That's pretty wicked. So what do you want to get out of that?
Well, I think in a lot of jobs, you leave your personality at the door, but in a bookshop, you bring your personality in. So one moment, somebody will ask you for the next Jeffrey Archer. And in the next moment, they'll ask, you know, have you got a book that proves the existence of God or something on Velasquez? So I think you need to be quite mentally open. Somebody said that my questions were as bad as a Google interview and it's just for an underpaid bookshop job. But, you know, I quite like that. And my daughter said to me, Daddy, I'd hate to be interviewed by you. Has anyone asked you those questions? And they haven't, thank God. One person did cleverly say about the vampire question, only one person said this, well, what time of day are we talking? No one else is puzzling over the fight, but this
You're hired.
Yeah, that's why I asked those weird questions. I met a bookseller recently who I interviewed 20 years ago, and he said, you asked me what song I'd have played at my funeral. And I was really offended. But since then, I've really thought about that a lot, and now I discuss it with my daughters, and it's become a big fun thing in our family.
So your book's about death then?
Yeah, I love death. And also, tell me about a book that would change your life. Some people said, oh, well, I wouldn't say a book can change your life. And I thought, you're not coming in here. Surely everyone has a book that's influenced their life in quite a big way. I suppose in their defense, they were saying that there isn't one book that transformed my whole life. But everyone has a book that's influenced their life, I think. I think we are changed and influenced by books.
Yes, for sure we are. Well, the book that I guess I might call there's a couple of them.
Yeah.
As I was a young boy, I'd say it was The Little Grey Men.
Wow, by B.B.
Yes.
Wow, that's neat.
But I really got serious about reading when I was in my early 30s, and I went through a ton of the great Russian writers, and they all kind of meld together but it was such a forceful, wonderful time where I would race home from work to get into that world. So I would go with War and Peace and Brothers Karamazov particularly. And then finally, and again, this would be teenagers, it'd be in between those two times, a really hokey title. I was just talking about it this morning on an interview with someone, and it's Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill.
Oh, now that is the part of the secret canon. That still sells like Lolita in piles, and we even sell a gift hardback of it still. What's the enduring power of that?
It infuses you with an incredible sense of power, I think, and a drive to succeed in not just money, but whatever you want to do in your life. That's why I keep trying to get my daughters to read it. It's a bit of a family joke. In fact, I'm sending them both paperback copies for Christmas this year again.
Right. Well, I tell you, a funny thing about that book is that we sell it from business, but we also sell it from self-help. And it's pretty unusual to sell a book from both places. That underlines what you're saying. Tell me about Dostoevsky, because a customer told me the other day that Crime and Punishment has a happy ending and it's worth persevering with. It's not this big downer. And he said he didn't like Karamazov because you can tell it was written almost as a serial more. It's a very stop-start book. So which one would you... Because I haven't got through a single Dostoevsky. I've started Crime and Punishment. Which of those two books would you recommend?
Well, I recommend them both. I think what happened with Crime and Punishment is he had a deadline and he sped it up and he whipped in a kind of a religious ending to it. And that may have put some people off, but it's very intense, kind of a detective story. But
right. I think
just in terms of sort of a life-affirming novel that's rich and huge, deep, Karamazov is... Again, I might hate them now, but I read them at exactly the right time in my life.
Yeah. Do you know who's a massive fan of Karamazov and speaks about it very eloquently in Desert Island Discs that we have here? And that's Martin Sheen. Is it Martin Sheen who's in West Wing? It is Martin Sheen. It is absolutely not just his favorite book, but it was like a religious revelation for him.
Yeah, well, it's got the Grand Inquisitor sequence in it, which is so powerful.
Oh, well, don't spoil it for me. That's on my shelf since hearing Martin Sheen talking about it and now underlined by you. What was it about the little grey men?
I really don't remember much other than they had this sort of idyllic little life on this little stream. And it was just so visual. I just felt that I was living on this lovely little peaceful stream with them. But it gets a bit weird because I think they get this toy boat and, you know, a human has interfered with things. And so it gets a bit weird.
I felt the same way about The Wind in the Willows. The living on the river was so nice.
Yeah.
As a kid, really wanted to be on that river. Actually, the other day I sold, and it's an unusual thing to sell, and it's the only thing I've sold all year. I've never sold one before. The Countryman's Bedside book, which is by BB. I don't know what it is, and it's published by an old-fashioned publisher, and it's his sort of country book, lovely dated book about country life.
What does BB stand for, do you know?
I don't know. I thought you'd know about BB.
No.
We need to find out. I'm going to find out.
That's a good challenge. So let me just end here like you end the book.
Yeah.
I've been to the Montague Book Mill bookshop in Massachusetts. So it was just so great.
Oh my God.
Well, I've been to thousands though, Martin. I've taken thousands of photographs of bookshops, but it was so nice to be able to, you know, visualize and know what you were talking about at the very end.
That's my dream. I just think it sounds so wonderful. I love that quotation. What is it? We're not beautiful. We're not efficient.
Do you have a copy of the book there?
Upstairs, I've got one. I can go and grab. I've got one right here.
Good. So why don't you read that, the whole last paragraph?
I'd love to do that. It's so hard to finish a book like that, which has so many parts to it. But I was really happy to finish it in that elegiac way. Think of that bookshop I hadn't been to and celebrate an independent that, as you and I have agreed, is probably sells secondhand books too, doesn't it? Secondhand book.
It does, yeah. Mostly, I think, or it did.
One day, I want to visit the Montague Bookmill bookshop in Massachusetts. It's in an old wooden flour mill. I hear it has idiosyncratic shelving rules, creaky wooden floors, and a cafe spread throughout the building. The owner says, "We're not particularly convenient, we're not particularly efficient, but we're beautiful. You can get hot chocolate and sit anywhere and read, or just listen to the river running under the ice outside."
That's great. Thank you, Martin. I met the owner at when I was there.
I've got to write him a letter, make sure he knows about the book. I'm going to write him a card.
For sure. Good. Okay, well, what a pleasure it's been to talk to you, and what a pleasure it was to read your book. Thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you. You've obviously read and digested the whole thing. It's really nice to talk to someone who got it, as it were, who really got it.
Very good. So the book is published by, it's interesting. I hadn't seen that imprint, Particular Books.
Yeah.
Part of Penguin.
Yeah, they set it up for a woman who was part of Penguin. She was an amazing editor there, and then she's left now and gone to someone else. But it's one of those imprints they set up because they had a remarkable editor who's doing unusual books. Helen Conford, Conford. And she's gone to run Profile Books now in the UK. Yeah, she's remarkable.
Isn't that great? Well, I can tell she's a good editor because this is one damn fine book, Martin. Thank you again.
Thank you. It's been great.